You are listening to a collaborative reflection on James chapter 1, led by J. Evan Kreider on Sunday, August 30th, 2026, at Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
We will now reflect on James.
When I was much younger, probably in my 20s, I attempted to memorize the whole book of James. I got as far as chapter 1, maybe a little bit into the beginning of chapter 2, but chapter 1 is very familiar. And it's good to see it in a different translation. I memorized, I think, probably the NIV, which was my common preferred version for many years. So it's a familiar chapter, but I think memorizing it, I didn't actually dig in. I just sort of let the words get into me. This has been a good time of reflection back on what were the things I struggled with back then. And I must say that the biggest struggle was the bit about asking God for wisdom. And if you doubt, you're like a ship tossed on the waves. So the footnote here was helpful that it's not meant that you can't doubt at all. And of course, we in this church don't shun doubting. But I'd be interested to hear what other people think of that thought, that passage.
Well, Frederick Buechner very wisely said that doubt are ants in the pants of faith. I mean, they're there to make you think more, I think. Like, I don't think it's unhealthy to doubt. And I mean, I've certainly struggled with as much as anyone, but I think in the end, it does make you reflect deeper if you doubt. Our book club, which is going to discuss it this Tuesday, is reading the book Everything is Tuberculosis, which is a reflection on the whole history of TB and how it's afflicted and affected the course of human history, because it has quite profoundly. And I just read this verse here in James, which says, the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let this endurance complete its work so that you may be fully mature. I just wonder how people thought when they were in the midst of TB, which until the 1940s, of course, was an untreatable disease. And so it was a death sentence. And I wonder how that affected people's sense of enduring when the end was so inevitable. The book points out, for instance, that tuberculosis had a powerful effect on the start of the First World War, because the assassin of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Gavriil Princip, had TB, as did his two best buddies. So the three of them all had terminal TB, and they were only like 19 years old. And so they hated the Archduke and they wanted to assassinate him, and they had nothing to lose. And so he did the assassination. And it's a real reflection of for me on how that must profoundly that must have affected one's Weltanschauung when you had an infection that couldn't be treated along with thousands of others.
On the wisdom, I had trouble with that for a while, and then I decided, okay, maybe it means this. Wisdom, and I'll read first of all, wisdom will certainly be given to those who ask. Whoever asks should not hesitate. They should ask in faith without doubting. Whoever doubts is like the surf of the sea tossed and turned by the wind. So the doubting is not about doctrine, but it's doubting whether or not you can receive wisdom. And so then What's wisdom? One answer I got in a commentary said, knowledge is knowing about things. Wisdom is knowing how to be practical, how to apply things in a practical way. And the example they gave was, knowledge sees a red traffic light. Wisdom applies the brake. And so in a sense, wisdom may be common sense, guiding our actions in moral ways and ethical ways that we get from scripture. That's how I'm thinking of it so far.
A little postscript on that. I have heard it said that knowledge is that tomatoes are technically fruits, and wisdom is they don't, you can't make a fruit salad with them, or they don't go well in fruit salad.
As some of you know, I have a tendency to join boards and committees. And in almost all of the meetings of church-related boards and committees, there is a prayer at the beginning. And the person praying often asks for wisdom because of the decisions that are going to be made. I will confess that I have often doubted that, but I intend to take a different view from now on. And when people pray for wisdom before a meeting, I will look for it because I know it'll be there.
Sort of picking up on Evan's comment, I've in my studies and reflections, that sort of Aristotelian principle of practice and being shaped by practice. So if you, and the maturity that James talks about, it's, there's all those, well, what would you do if somebody held a gun to your loved one, you know, would you give up your peace stance and attack them to protect your loved one? To me, that's kind of a red herring question. It's like, I don't know what I would do. That's an extreme example. All I can do is hope that what I do is, has been, that I've been shaped by my faith, by what God commands and what I strive for, so that in that moment, I will act as I have been shaped. That's all I can hope for. So this practicing and acquiring wisdom is, it's practical. It's not a head thing. It's a practical thing.
I meditate on Toy Watson's 6 exercises for spiritual growth. But the first one is let go or act. And I think that somehow relates to James 1. And the other ones, they are the Canadian Mennonite, the last Canadian Mennonite. And I found them very helpful to check how many exercises I have done in the presence of God.
James was one of the books I was asked to teach when I taught a 2-week course in Eston, Saskatchewan. It, of course, was one of the few books in the Bible that I had never studied at Regent. So I had to do a lot of reading up before I was able to teach. And it's really interesting when you delve into the details of the original languages, because James uses 2 words here, doubt and double-mindedness, and they're not the same word. So I kind of think of it like when people are speaking and pondering difficult, complex things, they'll sometimes start with like an umbrella word And I kind of think of doubt as the umbrella word. It's the Greek word that means to waver, to be, you know, to kind of have this uncertainty. But then double-mindedness is a more specific kind of thing where you have two loyalties. And I think if we read it as though James is sharing with us his doubt journey and some of the things he has learned, because he was Jesus' brother. I mean, Jesus' family doesn't get a great rap early on, you know. they didn't get him. And so I'm sure James has a doubt journey. And when I think of who he was, what he lived through, and the way he uses language, it kind of changes the imperatives, the very strong languages he uses, like do this, do that, sort of like, this is what helped me. This is how I came to faith. And I encourage you to, like, I'm sharing my lived wisdom and my life journey. And when you hear someone's life journey, I think you hear it differently than it's if it's just a bunch of imperatives.
So that helps a bit because I look at the very first line and it irks me. Because it says, from James, a slave of God. Well, why slave? That just that word alone is this kind of annoying to me.
I found that very helpful, Laura, and also Evan, because I have carried this chapter quite heavily because I'm so far from being able to live like all of these very strong imperatives. And just this is sorry, was it on? Oh,
yeah, it's turned on. Okay.
I'm just thinking the insights already would have received because I've always read that verse about doubting about everything, my whole faith doubting. And is it really about doubting to believe that we can have wisdom? That all of a sudden makes it like, hey, that's a piece of doubting that I might find wisdom. That lifts the weight that I feel of actually the whole book of James. It's overwhelmingly detailed of all the details that my life doesn't look like. Overwhelming. And the idea that James's experience and personality shows through in this book. It's a real other way to read it, actually. So that's all I'll say.
I'll just say something about slave. Usually it's translated servant. But I think there were very few servants in antiquity. There were slaves. Even in Judea, there were a predominant population of slaves. And I've read some books about slavery, and I had no idea how it permeated society. One of the ideas that's more powerful with the word slave, a slave has no choice. A slave does it or can be punished in any way, including death. A servant implies to us sort of an English servant who can go to another master. Slaves do not have that choice. And so I sort of like that, James feeling is a slave of God. He has no choice. I always think we have a choice. And so this comes against that. And so when I saw the word slave, I embraced it.
I've heard that word also translated as a bond servant.
which is someone who is in a relationship with the master because of debt, and they're bonded in some way. So they, until that they work enough to pay off that debt, they can't leave that person and go to another master. That, so it's, I think it's something like that. And so maybe the implication is that we are in debt to God because of, like, because of our salvation, because, so we are, you know, we owe our lives to him. And yeah, maybe it's a little bit easier to take in that sense. It doesn't look like the slavery of grabbing someone who was independent before and forcing them to work for you, like what happened in slavery in the South, in the US, or in other parts of the world that's happened.
Okay, I hope people can hear me. So this chapter was difficult. I didn't really relate to it. I didn't study it that much either, but until I got to the last verse about true devotion, the kind that is pure and faultless before God the Father, is this: to care for the orphans and widows in their difficulties, and to keep the world from contaminating us. The last part is could deserve some more explanation. But then this morning we were talking about verse 19. Oh, I'm going to give an example here. We're talking about slow to grow angry, and Evan said, is that possible? And we had an incident this last week, and he gave me permission to tell about it. He likes to cut his corn off the cob because it's easier to chew. So he was doing that, and suddenly the knife flew out of his hand, the cob flew somewhere, there was bits of corn all over the floor and the counter. And Evan quickly threw the cob, I think you maybe threw the knife too. Nobody was hurt, so nobody was hurt. Yeah, so that's a quick anger, but it's soon over with. He's not angry at that cob anymore. maybe he is. But then I thought about it. The bad thing about anger is when you harbor it. And that's sort of what the next verse is about. An angry person doesn't produce God's righteousness. And that's something for the psychologists and chaplains to figure out.
I have to follow up on Genesis and your about anger, because it happened to me this morning, and it's discouraging when your anger gets out of hand, and you look and say, when am I going to grow up and be able to be more mature? I was leaving my home and I got to the first roundabout by UBC, and I realized that the road was closed because there was a biking, I guess there was a race of some sort. And there was the girl there, the young girl, who was kind of helping with traffic. There were no other cars. And it said to turn right to go to Marine Drive. And I'm sitting right before the roundabout, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, I'll just turn around and go back and go a different way. And she came up to me and she said, you need to go right. And I said, she said, well, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm actually heading that the opposite direction. And she says, well, you need to go right. And I said, well, can I just turn around here and go back the other way? No, you can't. And it just surprised me. And I thought, then I got, you know, instead of saying, what kind of a day are you having, you know, or something more kind. And I said, well, I live here and I need to go that. I just need to go back. And she said, no. And she stood right in front of the car, so I couldn't move forward. So I decided, okay, I'm just going to back up all the way until I can go behind the middle part there and turn around at a different point. And she watched me do that. And I struggle with that even after thinking about that. And right now, too, I'm thinking, what kind of response could I have differently initially instead of the angry?
So we all know that we are made in the image of God. And I think that's everyone, not just Christians. And I work at a place with thousands of years of post-secondary education in the company I work for. And I see what humans can do who have not asked God for wisdom, but they've taken their knowledge and their wisdom to create something that no one else in the world can do. And I wonder what would happen if they asked God for wisdom, and what more they could do than what they're doing now. Because we're poking the edge of the unseen that God has created for us to find.
It occurs to me that after Kevin's recent sermon on artificial intelligence, combining that with our conversation today, I don't think it's possible to have artificial wisdom.
Well, it is important to be slow to anger. It doesn't mean that anger has no place. In the 10 years that it took to get smoking out of our hospitals, I was sort of in the vanguard of that at BC Women's and Children's. And it was difficult at times not to be angry at people who resisted such an, what certainly in retrospect was a very obvious need. And I found that really, I really struggled with that at times because my, it was just such a clear right. And you smoking in a non-smoking area is such a clear wrong that I, my family has poked a lot of fun at me about that over the years. And I remember one time walking into a restaurant, just as that whole thing was evolving, and my middle son was about 12, and and there's someone smoking on the corner of the room, and Matt holding onto my arm and going, "Dad, just please don't say anything." So righteous anger is a difficult thing to define, even, I think, because certainly there is a time to be annoyed about things.
It seems to me that we associate wisdom with old age and with maturity. And that's the way it should be. But when we sit back and consider that, I'm more impressed with wisdom from children these days than with their parents. I think we have a lot to learn about that is from children. And they're innocent, because so that they don't even know that they are wise.
Yeah. Out of the mouth of babes, eh? When they talk about things like that. I had a friend who is a child play therapist, and she was dealing with children who were dying from cancer, and they would use drawings to illustrate what they were experiencing. And when you go to these types of lectures, it's amazing what these children are thinking at that point in their lives. And as you say, this wisdom that comes from nowhere, or they don't understand where it's coming, but it's there. So I thought that was a great point you raised. For me, I always find these things, there's contradictions throughout. You know, on one hand, I've never been a fan of blind faith, you know, people who just suddenly believe in the dogma and do whatever they're supposed to do. And we get this in politics all the time, where people are saying, yeah, we want this, but then they're allowing people to clearly contradict that, and they follow them anyways. And I find that to me is a warning. And for me, all through university, when I was taking courses in philosophy, and there's always this concept of free will and the importance of free will. And yet, you know, we are told to follow something. And so you always have to challenge that. And there's always a contradiction. And so for me, this whole idea of wisdom is certainly to be given to those who ask. And in this case, whoever asks shouldn't hesitate. And so when I look at this, and I see this week in particular, the news has been, quite frankly, horrible. I mean, there's been things happening in Nepal, and we're getting videos of things that we shouldn't be seeing, but we see them anyways. And politics and the free trade, all this stuff that's going on. And the problem is we take it all in and then we get overwhelmed and then we can't function. And in this case, this is where I take to heart the idea that they should ask in faith without doubting, because if you can find your faith, you should find some peace in that, because otherwise we just find that we see too much going on. And they talk about this with children that have anxiety because of social media and what they see in the news, and there's just too much. I mean, we never knew what happened, 200 years ago, something happened in the next county or in the next village. You'd never know about it, or you might, but only a little bit. And now we know everything, the butterfly effect, everything's going on around in the world. And that's just too much. And I think it wears people down. And when you're worn down, you make mistakes. And we talk about this with driving in the cars and getting mad at drivers and everything else because we're getting lost in where we're going. So for me, I think I take a lot of solace in the idea that you have to come to terms with this and you shouldn't ask. Whoever asks shouldn't hesitate. They should ask in faith without doubting. And this is the key for me. Without doubt is like the surf in the sea. Whoever doubts is like the surf in the sea. And that's what I was talking about a second ago about being overwhelmed. And I think, if we can find groundness and believe in something that's greater than yourself, then I think that's where we are trying to go. So thanks for listening.
I was in a boat yesterday and it got very, very choppy halfway between Anvil Island and the harbor in Vancouver. And so what it's like to be in a choppy sea is very fresh and it's very uncomfortable. Something changed in that boat full of teenagers and parents and leaders coming home from a camp. Something really happened. And I think that's what you're saying, Jonathan, is that peace is at great cost for by taking all of this in. And this is why, for myself personally, I'm drawn to this text, this verse in James 1. Therefore, with humility, set aside all moral filth and the growth of wickedness. That doesn't feel like it's haunting me. But it says, welcome the word planted deep inside you. And I find for myself, that is what gives me calm. That is what, when I really read that thread through the word and the amazing words and texts and promises and reminders, I found that Psalm, 112 we read this morning was just amazing. And that is what settles my overactive brain and curiosity, because I'm a very curious person. I love to learn. And the more you take in, the more you have to deal with. And this is what is grounding, and that is what is so solid. And I like how it's put there. Welcome the word planted deep inside you, the very word that is able to save you.
I'll have two last comments on this. One is, as I read about the anger passage, and I've been consumed with the news, it just reminded me of the difference between Trump and Carney, how Trump acts out of anger, and commentator after commentator has pointed out that Carney has acted without anger and has acted promptly but not reflexively, and that has acted thoughtfully, none of which we can accuse Trump of. The other thing is, we've completely forgotten about the passage about the poor and the wealthy. And I struggled with that. Musk came to mind. When I first heard about him and first rode in a Tesla, I thought this man was sent from God. I just thought, how can anyone do these things? It's so wonderful. And then increasingly, I saw that money is not the answer, that I had put him on a certain plane because of money and Teslas. But the more I've been reading about people with a lot of money and how that consumes them and their interpretation of law, it does remind me of the problems of the Old Testament. It's natural for me to give more credence to someone who's wealthy than someone who is not. And I just have to be aware of that and not follow that. Thank you very much. So many of you shared, and it was a benefit to the whole fellowship.